This is Kelly Blewett. I'm talking tonight with Katie Butler, a journalist, about her book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Why do you think that dying well is an art?
I say it's an art for two reasons. The first is that we've come to think of ourselves as very passive bundles of diagnoses as we approach the ends of our lives. And I think some of us have forgotten that we still have agency and the capacity to shape our experience and how we behave, even down to our very last breath. And so that's why one of the reasons I call it an art. I want to return to people a sense of agency. Second is that an art is not something you completely control. You're working with the materials at hand, and they are going to be very imperfect materials, and you are going to be able to shape something of beauty and meaning out of those materials. But I'm not going to pretend that we have complete control of the way that we come to the ends of our lives.
Your first book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, was a really personal look at the passing of your father. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that book and readers' response, and then what you wanted to do differently in The Art of Dying Well, which is a very different kind of book.
Yes, exactly. What happened with my father is that he was very healthy till he was 79. He then had a major stroke that really destroyed his quality of life. He then descended into dementia and near blindness and absolute misery over time, over 6.5 years. And unfortunately, early in that process, he was given a pacemaker, which I came to believe, and my mother, was a terrible mistake, and that it actually prolonged this very, very painful part of his life for at least 2 years. So the first book, I think, really described as a personal memoir what it was like to be a caregiver, how our family changed as a result, some ways very much for the better. I became a much more open and loving person as a result of helping care for my dad. And it also took a look at what is the problem of modern death? Why are we so incapable of talking about the end of life and saying no to medical interventions that can prolong the very end of our life when the quality of life is just not there anymore? So in a way, I feel like the first book really laid out a problem. It got an enormous response. It was named a notable book of the year by the New York Times. But beyond that, I got probably thousands of emails and responses from people about various versions of my own family's struggle that their families had gone through, and how difficult these end-of-life decisions were, and how much more subtle they were than they're often portrayed. Because we think in terms of, I don't want to die plugged into machines. And we sign an advance directive and we think problem solved. But actually, the experience of our family was that this was a series of branching forks and subtle micro decisions. And those are much more difficult to make than that kind of black and white, don't put me in the ICU. So in a way, I feel like the book really laid out a problem. And I wanted to offer people whatever makeshift solutions are possible when we're dealing essentially with a very fragmented medical system that doesn't really handle either decline or death very well. So I wanted to empower people and write about solutions.
Absolutely. And I'm really looking at the subtitle, A Practical Guide. And the chapter titles almost seem like they're guiding us through stages that one might experience as they're approaching the end of life. And it's things like resilience, slowing down, adaptation, awareness of mortality. And within each of those chapters, you found people to profile who were just very forthcoming about how their life was changing in the midst of these different stages of elder life. And I wondered if you wanted to speak a little bit to that.
Sure. Again, I realize the whole problem is much more subtle. At each of these stages, medicine has a lot to offer you, but at each stage, there's a pivot from one type of expectation of medicine to another. So, for example, in the stage of resilience, which sometimes is called like young old age or vigorous old age, when people are still, you know, totally charging out there and living their lives, you can still reverse incipient problems like diabetes. You can reverse it at that point if you make major lifestyle changes. And so the first chapter is very much about prevention. But then people move to other stages, like slowing down or adaptation, coping with some degree of disability, where things can no longer be reversed. And then you need to pivot. And you pivot away from concentrating on prevention, and you pivot towards things like physical therapy, getting help in the home, occupational therapy. As long as you're kind of looking for the right medical allies and staying away from the wrong ones, because I think we all know at this point our medical system is so focused on prolonging life and on drug interventions and on surgical interventions. And what I want to say to people is, when you get into these last seven stages of life, which you could be in your 60s, 70s, or 80s, you could also be a lot younger and have a cancer diagnosis, and you're going to go through a version of these stages too. When you go through those stages, you need to make these pivots so that you get the kind of medicine that is really going to benefit you and stay away from some of the things that could actually harm you at that point. So, for example, when you're young, taking a drug can be a no-brainer. But when you're older and your body tissues retain drugs longer and you start taking more and more drugs on top of each other, you really need to get savvy and actually protect yourself from too much drug intervention.
It seems like one of the things you point out, too, is that these pivots can be made with more awareness of local resources and a larger view of the terrain. Of
yes.
What other people are doing. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit. You profile a woman in your last chapter, Louise Manfredi, and
yes.
The particular role that something called the Program of All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly, or PACE, played
yes.
in her end of life. And it just, honestly, it just blew my mind because it protected her whole family, her whole sort of ecosystem, as she was going through some very fragile adjustments, changes, and having that outside support made a huge difference for her.
Yeah, I find her story so heartbreaking because I feel everybody ought to get this level of support. And it just broke my heart to see how beautifully her family could handle taking care of her as a result of all the external support they got. So the PACE program is a national program funded by the federal government, and its purpose is to keep frail elderly people living with their families by giving the families enough support to make that possible. So it diverts people out of nursing homes, which are very expensive for the federal government, and produce a really horrible quality of life often for the person who has to be essentially incarcerated in one of these custodial institutions. So Louise Manfredi had had a major brain bleed, actually in her 50s. And so she'd been dependent for quite a while on her family. And her husband became absolutely exhausted. And around the age of 76, she got, thanks to her daughter, she got put into this PACE program, which did everything. It provided a van to take her to a daycare program 3 days a week. It sent her home with all of her pills in little plastic containers, so all her husband had to do was break them open. It sent meals for the weekend. As she started to decline, they provided different types of services for her. And the result was she was so well supported practically that her family could keep her at home. And her death ended up being an extremely beautiful death. And the reason that I called the subtitle of the book has the phrase, a practical guide, is I feel like if we can take care of the practicalities, then the spirituality and the emotional beauty of the end of life can kind of take care of itself. But if you don't have those practical supports, it's very difficult to expect that somebody is also going to be able to regard their death as a meaningful rite of passage. Her whole family was left with beautiful memories and with none of the trauma that I have seen so many families go through. The strange thing is, for people who are not in a PACE program, you pretty much have to be on hospice to be getting the level of support that she was getting. But she got that support for 8 years, and she died a very beautiful death in an inpatient hospice unit.
Well, Katie, thank you for talking a little bit with us about your book, The Art of Dying Well. I think that it's a book that will meet people and ultimately offer a hopeful and empowering look at what end of life can look like.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was really a pleasure to do.
I've been talking with Katie Butler, author of the book, The Art of Dying Well, published by Scribner. More information on this title can be found on our website, wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. This is Kelly Blewett.